When you run down the list of things that are necessary for a democratic society, novels might not be on the top of that list, but our next guest sees them as necessary. And Zahra Nafisi would seem to have a point, especially when you think of repressive societies like the Soviet Union. They did and do today still put a great deal of pressure on the creators of works of fiction, works of the imagination. Our guest picks up what she sees as some of America's most important novels in her book, The Republic of Imagination. Zahra Nafisi is well known in many countries now as the author of Reading Lolita in Tehran, which hung around the bestseller list for a long time and is now published in 32 languages. Zahra was born in Tehran and spent 18 years teaching English literature there. She's now a fellow at Johns Hopkins University's School of Advanced International Studies. The Republic of Imagination came out last year and is just out in paperback. Zahra Nafisi, thank you so much for joining us on The Exchange today.
Thank you so much for having me.
You speak about fiction as an antidote to ideology. That's a really interesting term. What does it mean?
Well, you know, when we talk about ideology, and I believe that partly right now we are living both in the world and in this country in an age of ideology where, you know, there is a sort of a black and white way of looking at things. So usually we are right and the ones who wear the black hats are wrong. And it gives you a sense of complacency, a sense of comfort, as if you know everything and you don't need to know more. You can make your decisions based on that. But what imagination does, it brings you freedom, and freedom a lot of times can also be dangerous because it opens not just the world as something ambiguous and complex, but it also makes you feel that you might be wrong. You not only question the world, but you're questioned yourself. And I believe that a democratic society is based on that constant give and take with the world and constant opening to the world rather than closing.
So the imagination not only opens up the mind, it opens up the heart as well, I think is what you're saying.
Oh, definitely. I mean, at the heart of imagination, in fact, is heart. And when you read so many novelists, they keep mentioning the hearts. I mean, Mark Twain, when he talks about Huckleberry Finn, he says something to the effect that this is about a book about the conflict between a sound heart and a deformed conscience in which the conscience suffers some defeat. So it is always related to the heart, definitely.
Zahra, you write in the introduction of The Republic of Imagination of a man you call Ramin. You never did learn his name. Tell us about that encounter.
Well, I was actually in your neighborhood. I have such amazing memories of Seattle and Portland, Oregon. Anyway, I was in this amazing bookstore autographing Reading Lolita in Tehran. And this young man was in the queue. And when it came to his turn, he didn't have a book for me to sign. But he told me that it was useless, what I was doing. He said, these people, meaning Americans, they're not like us. They don't copy Xerox hundreds of pages of Madame Bovary or Mark Twain. What he was trying to say was that it is useless talking books to people over here because they are not really interested. And that really, really bothered him. And so he stayed with me. He stayed in my mind, and he created this question for me that can a democratic society survive without a democratic imagination, or is imagination only workable, quote-unquote, in repressive societies?
So was his point that we born in America don't appreciate our stories as much as people striving in other parts of the world?
Well, I basically disagree with that tenet, actually. I believe that we as human beings, no matter where we live, we need to imagine. You need imagination, not just in terms of humanities and literature, you need it for science, because it is a sort of a survival tool. It is about being human. Human beings need to be curious about the world in order to survive. We don't know the world. We don't know how to control it. We don't know how to control nature. So we have to be able to have this curiosity to go after what we don't know. And that is where imagination comes. And then we also need to connect to the world, to connect to others who are not like us, again, in order to survive, in order to create communities. And that needs empathy. And that is why stories have been with us since the dawn of time. And I believe and I hope that stories will be with us long after we are gone. But that doesn't mean that democratic societies don't go through this crisis, and that if we just let things go, we can live with imagination, we can live with freedom. I believe that right now we are in a period of crisis. And the crisis is neither just economic or political, but it's a crisis of vision. And this is the time we really need the power of imagination to open the doors to us.
As I mold the basic thesis here that we need fiction, we need stories, I was trying to think of what, I mean, I read a lot of nonfiction for this job, but then it occurred to me, oh, wait, in fiction you get inside other people's hearts and heads.
Yeah, you know, Saul Bellow talks about how he is afraid that in a democracy, the danger to a democracy is not repression or open brutality, but something far more, in a sense, if not insidious, at least hidden. And it is our sleeping consciousness and our atrophy of feeling. And the way you are describing it, I think, addresses those issues, that reading stories, I mean, all art, everything that has to do with imagination, it sort of opens our senses. It awakens our consciousness. It awakens our feelings. And it opens us to the world. And that is the only way that you can live, not just live, but live fully. So it is not just a political matter. It is about the well-being and the health of us as human beings. And also, this is what we all have in common. In terms of politics, in terms of reality, there are constant borders. There are constant limitations of language, of religion, of ethnicity, of race, of gender.
Okay,
of
let's pause. We need to pause there. I'm sorry, but we need to take a break.
Okay.
Azar Nafisi is our guest. Her book is The Republic of Imagination. Back with her and with your phone calls and emails in 1 minute. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Azar Nafisi, born in Iran, taught literature, Western literature there, ended up leaving, becoming an American citizen. Her earlier book is Reading Lolita in Tehran. Her current book is called The Republic of Imagination, A Life in Books, in which she explains why we need fiction for democratic societies to thrive. She chooses Huck Finn, Babbitt, The Heart is a Lonely Hunter, and James Baldwin's Another Country for specific mention in this book. You can join our discussion on The Exchange about how necessary fiction might or might not be to our democratic system. 800-838-3760, around the region by phone, by email jx@jeffnet.org. You have said, Azar, that people expected you to talk, teach, and write as a woman from Iran. How was that expressed to you?
Well, that was one thing that really struck me as strange when I returned to U.S., that how we had sort of tried to make our minds complacent, but by putting ourselves and others in separate boxes, so that we, before they act or say anything or make themselves known to you, you already have defined them. And I was, at least in the academic community, immediately defined as a woman coming from Iran, coming from a Muslim society. And I was told that I should, I would be very successful in the field of women's studies or Islamic studies. And I told them, no, you go and teach women's studies and Islamic studies. I want to teach dead white males. Because the whole idea of knowledge, the whole idea of education is to take you outside of yourself and to make you know and write about and think about people who are not like you. Even people you don't like, you need to understand and know. So I sort of rebelled against that.
I can see that. It made you bristle quite a bit, it sounds like.
Yes, because you see, the whole point, the real danger to a democracy is a sense of complacency, a sense of comfort, wanting to be constantly entertained and putting people in boxes. The way we do it, not just in our education system today, we do it even with the news. We turn on only the channels and hear the news from people we agree with. And I feel that that is very dangerous. And that if in Iran open repression threatened us, over here, this sense of conformity and complacency that each of the novels I talk about target as the first danger to this country, those are the real dangers.
It's not like we resist fiction or stories. We just tend to get them through avenues other than books. I mean, TV is thriving, but you just mentioned how we can tend to entertain ourselves. That's not the same thing as reading a novel, though, by a long shot, I'm going to guess.
No, and you know, I think that we can satisfy our imagination on different levels and through different venues. So it is not that I'm against TV or I'm against entertainment. I become against it when it becomes the sole thing or the dominating factor in our lives. So that even our children, when they go to college, they ask for trigger warnings. They don't want to be made uncomfortable. They become so sensitive that they cannot tolerate the pains that fiction describes. I don't know how they can tolerate the pain and violence that life puts forth every day in our lives. That is why I think that we need to, and I think that our policymakers and our elite are mistaken to segregate humanities and literature and arts from sciences and from technology and prefer one over the other.
Azar Nafisi, again, our guest on The Exchange. Her book, The Republic of Imagination, just in general talks about books in the in your book. You point out that Bloomberg News put its book reviews in its luxury section as if books are a luxury. It's a really interesting comment.
Yes, I know. I mean, it is sort of amazing that Bloomberg News is a good example, but among our elite, our policymakers, whether they're Republican or Democrat, you hear this, that, for example, museums or concert halls or poetry or literature, these are all quote-unquote useless. And how could you say this in a country that was essentially based on an idea? I mean, when you go back to the founders, which everyone is so fond of quoting, you see that those people had to imagine something that didn't exist, and they very much based the foundation of this country on the legacy of what Washington called the legacy of enlightenment. And every single movement in this country, from civil war to civil rights, right to the present, has been based on this ability to imagine what doesn't exist.
That particular section that you just talked about just really jumps out of the book at us about the fact that we were a country created during the Enlightenment, and Washington's the first part of his quote was, "The foundation of our empire was not laid in the gloomy age of ignorance and suspicion." So
yes.
You're saying that Washington and the founders really thought that, hey, we are a people of arts and culture.
God, I'm so glad you brought that, you quoted that part, from Washington. And I feel sometimes, you know, I'm not pessimistic, I'm hopeful, but I feel sometimes as if we are encouraging people to live in this age of suspicion and gloom. This is not how this country was founded on, since we keep talking about the Constitution and the Bill of Rights. And for a migrant, people like me, people who come from all over the world with different backgrounds, they come to this country because they have a dream. And that dream is not just becoming Donald Trump. There's more to it than that.
One of the pivotal books that you tell us about, not one of the ones that you're using as examples for the purposes of this book, but just from a story of your own youth, The Wonderful Wizard of Oz was a pivotal book for you as a kid. But you do point out that Dorothy leaves a bleak land for a world of brilliant color, but she wants to go home anyway.
Yes, that was, there were two things that now strike me about that story, and I believe that that is very American in a good sense of the word. One is that when the Wizard of Oz sees Dorothy, he says, "I am Oz, the powerful and the great," and Dorothy says, "I am Dorothy, the meek, the small and the meek." Because the heroes, the great heroes of American fiction, are these strong, meek people. you know, like Dorothy and Hawk. And the second thing is that at the heart of the desert in Kansas, there is an Oz. You go to that Oz to learn, to look at the world differently, but you want to come back. And that is the beauty of it, that Dorothy finds beauty, tenderness, and love when she leaves Kansas, in that Kansas, which is a desert.
You know, as I think about the strong and powerful and the small and meek, I think about the fact that even some of the figures in other parts of our fiction, in this case comic books, I mean, Superman is this tremendously powerful figure, but he spends his daily life as a mild-mannered reporter who wears glasses.
That is the whole point. I mean, that is what the foundation of this country was based on, because this is supposed to be a democracy, which means that, you know, we were sort of distancing ourselves from everything that the aristocracy, which the War of Independence was all about, we're distancing ourselves from that. And we believe in the power of the individuals, not the way some of our politicians are saying today. Being an individualist doesn't mean carrying a gun and talking about this is a dog-eat-dog-eat world and each of us for its own. No. Individualism in this country is the way Dorothy and Huck Finn define it, which is very much connecting to others and growing up as an individual in relation to others.
Azar Nafisi is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her book, now out in paperback, is called The Republic of Imagination, A Life in Books. She tracks Huckleberry Finn and Sinclair Lewis's Babbitt and Carson McCullers' The Heart is a Lonely Hunter and James Baldwin's Another Country as examples of the kinds of fiction that really represent us as Americans, and that fiction is necessary to our well-being as a democratic society. You've been a citizen in the United States since 2008. You did consider calling the book Becoming an American. Talk about the process of picking. I mean, this is a difficult task for anyone who's lived here for, you know, 20 years or 70 years, figuring out the books that best typify America. How did you come up with this process?
Well, you know, the whole idea about becoming an American was that I mentioned in the book that when I believe that when you love a country, it is not that you always sing its praises, but when you become anxious about it, when you start grumbling. And I was grumbling all the time. So I thought, okay, maybe I am an American, or I should become an American in order to respond to my own complaints, you know. And the books that I chose, of course, Mark Twain, I just want to remind you, Mark Twain was the person who said patriotism is loving your country all of the time and its government when it deserves it. So that became my motto. And I chose writers. Of course, there are amazing array of writers, and at first I had at least 24 on my list. But I chose the writers who focus on this issue. Focused on defining America different from the way I saw so many of our elite were defining it today, and going back to the grassroots where the novel comes from.
So your friend Farah, who has since died of cancer, I'm sorry, you and she talked about Huck a lot. Why?
Well, you know, she and I, we go back to the childhood. We went through the student movement. We went through a revolution. She lost her husband, who was executed. She had to escape Iran through illegal routes. And we came to this country with a great deal of dreams. And we both were English majors when we went to this country. And she identified a great deal with the themes in Huckleberry Finn, the theme of being always on the fringes, looking at the society, at what is confirmed through the eye of a stranger. And both of us felt that this is the country that accepts strangers, that accepts outsiders. That didn't mean that it closed our eyes to what we felt were their faults.
We talked about Washington and the other founders as products of the Enlightenment. And Huckleberry Finn himself, you see him as a product of the Enlightenment. In what sense?
I see him as a product of the environment and sort of the declaration of America's literary independence, because Mark Twain created a new characters in Huck and Jim, new landscape in Huckleberry Finn, even a new language, which was solely and fully American. And I find him as a sort of a product of the Enlightenment, because he genuinely believes, without knowing it, because he goes with his heart, he genuinely believes in equality. He doesn't know it. He doesn't formulate it this way. But look at the way he, who was born in a racist society, who on the surface believes in racist things, who even thinks he goes to hell if he helps a slave escape, through his heart, he opens up to Jim. And through his heart, he understands that this is a person with the same feelings, that it is not right that a father should be separated from his children. And he is constantly going against that materialistic aspects of this society that makes it dangerous to itself when it is too much focused upon.
So within the pages of Huckleberry Finn, who are the villains, in essence?
Well, you know, within the pages of the novel and Huckleberry Finn, the blind are the conformists, and the conformists are those who cannot see. So slavery becomes the center whereby we judge the characters. From the God-fearing Miss Watson to the lovely and kind Aunt Sally, they all close their hearts to the others. They don't see. So no matter how kind and how lovely they are, they still could count as the villains. So does Pap, of course, Huck's father. And that is what I find so fascinating. The villain looks like you and me. And what Huck is telling us is that you don't have to have a mark of a villain on your forehead. It wasn't just those people who were wearing Ku Klux Klan masks that are the villains. We could close our heart and therefore close our eyes to others, and thereby we can also become the villains. We have a choice to become Huck and Jim or Tom, and Tom is my main villain, actually.
He really is. You really give Tom Sawyer a working over in this book. The book is called The Republic of Imagination. Azar Nafisi is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, its author. So the pillars of community, or at least the ones who are using their strictures and their rules first instead of their minds and hearts, are the ones who end up as villains. But there's some interesting parallel in Mark Twain's own life that you point out, because he went to go talk to Mayflower groups and said some things that they might not have appreciated too much.
Yes, he's so tongue-in-cheek, but right to the point, because he tells them that I'm not like you because you deprived me of my ancestors. And he goes through the list of his ancestors, beginning with the native Indians whom they killed, and then he goes through the Quakers and the witches, and ends with the slaves. And he says that you took all of these ancestors away from me. And he says, for I am an exquisite... what was it? Oh, God. I forgot how he explains himself as an exquisite mongrel.
Ah, that was a mongrel, yes, was the term.
Ah, exquisite mongrel. I mean, you know, if that does not, tell you what this country should be all about, what else can? I don't know. And right now in this country, there are those who are depriving us of becoming exquisite mongrels. You know, with the whole idea about immigration, which really breaks my heart.
Purity of race, purity of thought.
Yes.
Purity in ways that really end up... And what I think Twain was saying and you're agreeing with is that we need some dilution. We need some mixing.
We need some mixing. That is how we are constantly rejuvenated. A society that is confident of itself can be flexible, can accept all sorts into it, and can assimilate them, and be assimilated by them. You know, I mean, that is the great the greatness of a democracy and a country like this. And to narrow it is very, very, very dangerous.
Azar, what do you think about the scorn that is often heaped upon the book Huckleberry Finn now for language, for use of the term that for most people refer to as the N-word now, things like that?
You know, I would like to refer everyone to Toni Morrison's amazing introduction in the Oxford version of Huckleberry Finn. She says, she talks about the, you know, what, how people become disturbed by the use of that word. And she says those people who want to censor that word out of Huckleberry Finn, they are again condemning Jim to 150 years ago. They're condemning him back to slavery. Because of the point is that that word used within the context of the book brings out the amazing violence done against the African American people, against the, what they called slaves at that time. And the reason we become so disoriented when we hear the word from the lips of kind, lovely people is because it tells you how deep that is. No amount of physical violence against Jim or the slaves would have done the work of that word. And taking it out, you are lying about history. You're lying about reality. You want to comfort ourselves. And comfort is not the duty of fiction. As James Baldwin says, writers are here to disturb the peace. I love the fact that we are disturbed.
Yeah, okay, we're going to do more about afflicting the comfortable when we come back to the Jefferson Exchange with Azar Nafisi, the author of The Republic of Imagination. Back with her and with your phone calls and emails when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute five. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening to us here on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. We are talking today about fiction and its importance to a democratic society. Azar Nafisi, who is the author of Reading Lolita in Tehran, she is from Iran originally, now an American citizen, writes very passionately about the importance of fiction in a democratic society, that we need good stories. We need to get inside other people's heads and hearts to be able to be better at being with each other. Her book is called The Republic of Imagination, A Life in Books, now out in paperback. You can join our discussion on the exchange at 800-838-3760. 800-838-3760 works anywhere. Our email address, jx@jeffnet.org. Azar, you write of, you talk of writers bearing the burden of reclaiming America from politicians. Do you see politics as the land of anti-imagination?
Well, I see politics the way it's practiced today as land of anti-imagination because, you know, we used to have statesmen who would wheel and deal but who had ideals and who stuck to their principles and who were not afraid of failing but doing the right thing, which is what Huck does and which is every hero in this book that I talk about does. And that is why politics gives you formulas. Politics gives you things that you want to hear in order to have people elected. Imagination goes exactly against the grain of politics. It questions you. It takes you to new lands. It leaves you there to, like Alice, to wander around and be surprised. So I think in that sense, yes, they go against one another. And I believe with Joseph Brodsky, the Nobel laureate dissident from Russia, when he said that I like our presidents to have read fiction and novel and literature, I believe that they will make better presidents.
Huh, interesting. We have an email here from Jay in Walterville. He writes, fiction is based on reality, nonfiction first, with added dreaming and embellishment. Much of what Burroughs, H.G. Wells, even Poe et al. Have become reality as a product of the imagination and thinking outside the box over time. If we can dream, it will happen. Besides, it is fun to get less serious for a moment to escape. Steve Jobs types, too many dreamers have been laughed at in the moment. That from Jay in Walterville.
That is fantastic. I completely agree with what he says. And in this book, I mention, when I'm talking about Babbitt, but also any of these books, how fiction predicts us. So, for example, when you read Babbitt, sometimes you feel that you're listening to some politician on television. And when you read Babbitt, you also think about yourself, that am I not the one who is so much in love with gadgets, who stands all night waiting for the new, iPhone to come out? You know, so I completely agree that and fiction takes you to another land, like the land of Oz, in order for you to come back with your eyes refreshed.
Babbitt, of course, by Sinclair Lewis, won the Nobel Prize in 1930. And you see a continuum between Huckleberry Finn and Sinclair Lewis. Tell us about that.
Well, I believe that Sinclair Lewis himself had the restlessness and the pariah sort of status of Huck Finn. But Babbitt, of course, I brought him in because he's the exact anti-Huck. You know, and one character in Babbitt talks about the fact that people like Babbitt are dangerous because they're after standardization of thought. I believe that that is the other side of America, the other side to Huck Finn. We need to remember both sides.
So, you know, at this point, when we think about the main character in Babbitt and then back to Huckleberry Finn, the hero of his book, who is, you know, somebody who kind of works on the fringes of society. So you can understand how people would begin to wonder why the nonconformists and the undereducated petty thieves are the people you think we need to be familiar with.
Well, they are maybe like Huck Finn is uneducated. Some of them in other books, like Stoner, for example, they are educated, and yet they are standing outside. And that is very much what a writer or an artist or a philosopher does. You have to have the alternative eye. You cannot become so much part of the society that you don't see it anymore. And always a stranger sees things newly and in a fresh way. So these characters, no matter what background they come from, and they come from really various backgrounds, they have the eye. And I think that is what is important. To have the eye and to remind society that you need to sort of sometimes deviate from the routine in order to go back and do the right thing.
I noticed Babbitt has been described by some people as a plotless book. One critic said that the main character just gets 2 years older. That's the story of the book.
Yes, I know. Some people really dislike Babbitt and get bored by it. What fascinated me about Babbitt was the language. Actually, to tell you the truth, what fascinated me about each of these books I talked about are the language. Because through the language, these writers are creating new characters that are so essentially and quintessentially American. And that is what I enjoyed. Carson McCullers does it, and of course Baldwin does it so superbly as well. That is where I go for. In Babbitt, I go for language and not the plot.
So Carson McCullers' book that you feature here is The Heart is a Lonely Hunter. John Singer is deaf and mute, and you know none of his friends are particularly pillars of the community. So teach us what it is that we can learn from her book.
Well, first of all, again, I chose Carson McCullers because I felt that she brings in all the marginals that we've been talking about into one book. And she shows that how lonely one can become in a society like America, how solitary you become in these small towns or big towns where, you know, you have a dream, you have a passion, and you cannot talk to people. So these people, in fact, confide in a person who's deaf-mute who cannot respond to them. But there is one glimmer of hope for all of these characters, one way through which they might be able to connect to the world, and that is their passion. Mick, the young girl, has passion for music. One is a, you know, labor activist. Another one is an African-American doctor who is obsessed with his people and wants to regain the dignity of his people. So each of these people have a dream, and that dream is the glimmer of hope where they can have salvation and they can come out of isolation.
We have a call here from Christos in Ashland. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Azar Nafisi, the author of The Republic of Imagination.
I just wanted to thank Azar for reminding us to praise and search out the fringe dwellers in our world, because I consider exquisite mongrels the people I search out for a circle of friends, because they're always challenging me. And it gives me a view of the world that I wouldn't be comfortable with, but expands my worldview.
All right. So there's another vote for the exquisite mongrels.
Yes.
Thank you for that, Christos.
Thank you.
So the general run of the book is Huckleberry Finn, Babbitt, The Heart is a Lonely Hunter, and then Another Country, James Baldwin's book, appears in the epilogue. What did you find in Another Country that was worth
including? And of course, it was mainly in Go and Tell It to the Mountain.
Mm-hmm.
And I mentioned also another country, but James Baldwin also is one of those. First of all, I was amazed by the kind of life he led, that he was so immersed both in art and in life, and he lived through such horrible times. But what he found in his writing was that the most dangerous thing was not coming from without. It wasn't the white enemy simply that was destroying him. It was the hate that enemy produced in him that would paralyze him. And so he felt that you should go to a domain which is different from your enemy in order to fight that enemy. And of course, he so much in his novels mixes life with art. He also creates a new language. And in Go Tell It on a Mountain, I believe he creates a new character. And he brings in the Negro spirituals, the language of, particular language of African Americans. And I felt that that book should be alongside of other great American books. Like Catcher in the Rye. Mm-hmm. I think that he deserves that honor.
All right, I think you might have just named the book I was looking for. I was going to ask you what the first one out was, the one just outside the scope of this book that couldn't be included just for reasons of space and number.
Yes, and you know, when I came to Baldwin, I was going to write about him, but there was so much to say. There was so much to say. So Another Country, for example, where he brings in all these different characters. And Baldwin talks not only about African Americans. He goes under the skin of people who are exact opposite to him. His second novel, Giovanni's Room, he's talking about a white gay male in Paris. And his agent and his publisher both told him not to publish that book. And he said, I told them, go and whatever yourselves. And he went and published it in London because he didn't want to be categorized. When you are categorized, you're marginalized. And in each of his novels, he offered us something new. And his essays, are just absolutely, relevant to all times.
Azar, when I think about the way that we tend to teach humanities in America these days, I mean, first of all, there's the focus on we have to get better at math. I mean, there are some areas where our education system certainly does seem to lag.
Yeah.
On the other hand, there's also the place where we tend to cut education budgets first is places like arts.
Yeah.
Sports seem to be left alone mostly. But places of enrichment outside just the core of, like, this is what you know to get along in the world. And it seems like you view those, I'm just guessing here, as at least as important, if not more so.
Yes, definitely. You know, first of all, nowadays in our system of education, they keep talking about vocation. You know, and education is not only about vocation. I believe that in a democratic society, every citizen has the right to quality public education as well as quality public health. That is how we prepare our citizens for their future, and it is the duty of the public to give that to each citizen. Otherwise, how can you vote? How can you make choices? How can you make decisions in life? And that is where humanities comes in. And the way sometimes humanities is taught in our universities, especially, is either in a utilitarian manner or full of theory without allowing the students to connect to the books, to connect to the stories. And on the other hand, in our public schools, from kindergarten downwards now, we are cutting arts and music and poetry, which every great educator knows is fundamental to the growth of our children and of their mental abilities and their independence of mind.
You know, I can see some people making the case that, well, we need things like we need to be better at math and science and physics and things like that, just to be stronger in what the world throws at us these days. But do you think it is just an emphasis on the hard stuff rather than the quote-unquote softer stuff of fiction? Or is it, you think it's a little more deliberate than that, that there's a squelching going on there?
Well, you know, first of all, I object to those policymakers or education policymakers who segregate science and technology, or what they call STEM, from humanities. Because both genuine science and genuine humanities are based on curiosity, on this desire to know. And if you go to great scientists, and I'm just brought in my book two examples, one was Einstein, where he said imagination is even more important than scientific knowledge because imagination encircles the world. You see that they did not segregate music and arts and literature from genuine science. Those two worlds do not collide, are not separate, but they go together. So when I talk about humanities, it doesn't mean that I don't like science. It means that we need a system of education that understands when we talk about arts and sciences, it is because arts and sciences go together. And to deprive our children from one or the other is almost a crime.
Your passion for American authors is just about unsurpassed. Are there some authors from Iran through its history that you feel as passionately about?
Oh! Don't get me started on passionate about any country. I just, because I know we don't have time, I just would like to ask your listeners check out on the web the name Dick Davis, who is a British man who has been teaching at Ohio State and who fell in love with Iran and Iranian literature. He has translated from 11th century, 1,000 years ago, some of the most amazing books, including the great Persian epic, the Book of Kings. And you come right down to the present and to this amazingly funny novel called My Uncle Napoleon that shows Iran is nothing, nothing like what these politicians say. And the second thing I want to ask you is go to Mage Publishers, M-A-G-E, and look at their list and get to know Iran, because it is one of the most sensual and beautiful and colorful places you could find on the first of the earth.
All right. You leave us speechless. Azar Nafisi, Republic of Imagination, thank you so much for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.